Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. That was Fatboy Slim, Ya Mama, the radio edit, a short one, you'll be glad to hear. Before that, Horace X and Skin, the Strategy remix. And we kicked off, of course, with Slade, some good old Midlands glam rock there, which I really enjoyed listening to. Well, tonight I've got a kind of two-part show. I'm joined at the beginning by John McCann to talk about the official offer, and later on we'll be talking about one or two items that I've found in a very interesting magazine me and Synchro have been perusing called The Land, which is an occasional magazine about land rights and has some fascinating stuff in it. But right now I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show John McCann. John, thanks very much for coming back on.
Yeah, excellent. And the subject is right up my alley.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah, yes, you'll start off at 10. I'm listening to the various of you Irish guys on the show, on the various shows on PIR. I'm aware there seems to be you seem to be really coming together in Ireland with the Land League and your hedge schools and all the rest of it. What's your impression of how it's going over there? Do you think there's a real tide rising now?
There's certainly a lot of anger. Some of it is correct and some of it is maybe misplaced. But during austerity and when people are finding it difficult to cope and difficult to live, and most of our children are going off to foreign lands to work, can't find work, which is ever the problem in Ireland for as long as I can remember, all my life anyway. And then, of course, we have the vultures coming in, taking over bank accounts and all of that sort of thing, and just robbing and plundering. It's going on. It's not by an army anymore. It's by legalese and pieces of paper that they call contracts and various other things like that, which everybody's discovering here and across the UK as well. Piece of paper that don't really say what they're supposed to say, and people abusing that situation. And so we're fighting back. It's not all coming from People's Internet Radio, but a lot of it is. There are a variety of groups out there. The Land League, there's two Land Leagues apparently, the Hub, and they're all trying to deal with the same issues. But they take a slightly different approach than what we do. So the legal fraternity are kind of under the cosh at the moment, which is good. And the opposite to that is that once they come under the cosh for various things, they smarten up then, you know, and they bolt the doors and lock the doors and try to prevent us from doing things. And actually, it's a right mess. It's a right mess, you know.
It always makes me think it's a bit like the modern physics, where they've discovered that just having somebody watch something thoroughly changes the output of the experiment. And it seems to me to be the same thing with these legal eagles, that basically they've been getting away for certainly hundreds and maybe thousands of years without anybody observing. And now there's people observing, the situation has to change.
Yeah, well, I would agree there. And they're not supposed to change, of course. That's their motto, that everything stays the same. However, as we know, People's Internet Radio, the people have the power, not these people. And, yeah, we did sign pieces of paper and all of those things out of necessity in the majority of cases. And people wanted to have to live. You have to live somewhere. The choices, as I keep going on, weren't there. The rental sector was just as expensive as taking on a mortgage. And nobody takes on a mortgage, let's say, without the intention of paying it. And then when the masters in their wonderful world where they turn off the tap and the money stops flowing and businesses crash and people find themselves out of jobs and all sorts going on, what are people to do? You know, so we know that it's from the banking sector, it's all a big agenda and a kind of a scam, a con. But you can't go into court and say these things.
Well, the trouble is, really, in almost all these banking instances, what's happened in our language is that you've already kind of ceded jurisdiction, haven't you? And once that's done, it's quite difficult to undo.
Absolutely. It depends on what you're going into court for. This is like an aside. People go in and their name is called John McCann, and then I go up and say, I'm not John McCann. I mean, that's pretty daft, isn't it? So, on those occasions, I wouldn't be doing that myself personally, unless they were trying to arrest me, perhaps, or different situations. But, as I say, your home or your dwelling is a different thing altogether. And, it's a civil matter, by the way. It's not a criminal matter. And I'm not sure whether the courts are actually the right place for them to be heard, although it's all based on contract law. And to go in to any court and try and undo all the damage that they have done, no one person is going to be able to do that.
No. I think that's one of the great things about the fact that there are so many different approaches, as you were mentioning earlier. The system itself seems to be trying to be just one fist gripping very hard. But the more different approaches there are, especially if they work, you know, in their own context, then the more difficult the system is going to find to respond, is my feeling.
That's what we're living in hope for, really. Somebody will find probably a silver bullet here or there, you know. There's a lot of people trying. There's no doubt about it. A lot of people doing great work out there. However, when it comes to the mortgage aspects of things, I haven't really seen anything that matches up with the official offer.
No, I think that's exactly right. And that's why I really want to talk about it, because it's becoming more and more apparent, really, that more and more people are going to feel the need for such a solution. And I thought that for tonight, for the purposes of tonight, I'd kind of try and be a man in a bar, as it were, who's found himself in this position and who doesn't understand anything about the official offer. And I thought I might try to imagine him in his position and ask the questions he might ask, if that's cool with you.
That would be excellent.
Because I've heard people, you know, I'm actually surprised by how many people are a bit informed about what's going on in the background now. It seems clear to me that there are more people who find their backs against the wall, the more people there are who are going to be taking action. But the kind of thing I hear is, like, you know, I thought I was just borrowing some money, and I thought that I get to own my own home. I'm sure you've heard this as well. You know, I didn't realise I'd end up paying almost three times the asking price. Lots of people have tried many things, I don't know what they call them, agreed credit agreements or something. So they say, you know, I have been trying really hard to find a solution, and some people have found out that they've handed out some sort of legal power to the company that lent them the money. Some people have found out that the loan's guaranteed against a piece of paper and not against, you know, the actual bricks and mortar. Some people have even found out that no one at the office of the lender actually understands the terms and conditions under which all this has happened. But the thing that is common to all of them is that they find out that none of this seems to matter, that, you know, maybe their income's been reduced or whatever, and that for whatever reason they're currently unable to pay and expected to give up the keys. And like they say to me, you know, somebody else is going to reap the benefits of everything I've paid, like all the maintenance on the house, all the building, all the gardening, anything that's happened before this time, somebody's just going to steal all the benefit for that. And, you know, it's going to be a long, cold winter. And like they say, I mean, what's a man expected to do? So what would be your first move under those circumstances?
Well, the first, you see, this is why it's so important that people hear about this. Whether they use it or not, that's up to them. But it is important. For years, I wouldn't say years, but, you know, I got myself into a situation I had to remortgage. And I found that I couldn't keep it up. And the, let's say, the main players in all of this, the banks, solicitors, government people, councillors, you know, TDs or MPs or whatever, were only saying to people, I just hand up your keys, you know. So there was actually no help there for anybody. And it was like a big, the wall, Pink Floyd's The Wall, you're not getting by this, you know, this sort of thing. And it was very worrying for everybody. And because if you can't afford to pay for your home, well, you're not really able going to be able to rent somewhere, and all sorts of things. And it's very worrying for people. It has a terrible effect physically and mentally on people, and people have committed suicide from this, and all of these things. So if you listen to mainstream, going back to, see, 2011, 2010, 12, 13, 14, even up until now, there's none of those people offering any solutions to people. They've come up with little insolvency plans and all the rest of it, and all of their solutions tie you in with the banks or the vulture funds being in control of your future.
So they're kind of tying you into the people who, it seems to me, are somehow responsible for the problem in the first place.
Exactly. Like, for instance, just stepping a bit further, people say to me, well, why don't you just sell your house? Well, you see, these people won't let you sell your house. This is the whole thing, the trick in it. Because they have, they think they have dibs on it, let's say. And so you can't just go off and sell it and say, here, I'll sell it and I'll pay you back the money and then I'll try and exist and whatever's left on it, that sort of thing. That doesn't happen. They pretend that that's what they're doing, and they rope people in and say, well, we'll give you 6 months and we'll sell the house and we'll take whatever we need out of it and all the rest of it. When that happens, they usually find that not only was there extra interest, extra costs, they're even coming up with special offers, believe it or not, to say, we won't charge you for this, we won't charge you for that, we will pay solicitor's fees even, and all that kind of thing. But in the heat of the hunt, most people end up, let's say if their home was worth 200,000 and they owed 100,000, you know, they'll find themselves not only that 200,000 of the value of the home, because the bank or whatever they are called, they will come along and sell it, probably cheaply to maybe one of their friends. Maybe that might be a bit cheeky. So let's say they're honourable people and they sell it to cover their costs. Then you'll find in most of the cases that all these other things have been accruing and you still owe them money. So you don't get any benefits from it. It's a big scam.
That's quite shocking, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Oh, it's abominable.
It sounds like they're cooking the books, mate.
Well, yeah, they cook the books in a way, but by use of language. Nick played a clip earlier on about the use of words, and you'll find that the way these people write things, it appears that it's telling you something or saying something to you. It may not be, but it looks like it is. So they're all cleverly designed, very cleverly designed, for A, you to be afraid you're going to lose your home. They send out letters, let's say you didn't pay for 2 months or something like that. They're entitled to send you a letter to say that a default has occurred and you've got 10 days to get out of your home. And this is the ploy that they use. It's like a game of poker, really, or a game of chess.
It's not surprising under those circumstances that people seem not only desperate but quite confused.
The confusion gets more and more. Between securitization and people thinking that they have a solution, maybe, and they contract with the banks by talking to them. The way it's got now here in Ireland is that mostly you're not actually dealing with the original lender, let's say Bank of Ireland. It's probably sold on to other people, and now it's owned by Pepper, who was run by a company called Shoreline, who's being represented by a group of solicitors who are either working for Shoreline or Pepper and vice versa. And they're all usually over in the UK or America or somewhere else. And those people who bought all these securitized mortgages on the stock market for pennies on the pound, they are not unregulated bodies here in this country. But they can operate from UK or anywhere else.
So who do I actually owe the money to under those circumstances?
Ah, well, you see, that end of the process hasn't been sorted out yet. There was a case there 2 years ago where they tried to stop it because of the securitisation, Bank of Ireland Scotland, or Bank of Scotland Ireland, and all of this sort of stuff. Sold to them, and they sold it to them. They took it over, but it was a Northern Ireland office working for a Southern Ireland thing, and all of this mishmash. In the heat of the hunt, they said no, that they were entitled still to look, you know. In the heat of the hunt, the judge ruled that they would. being there is distracting me.
Yes, indeed. Yeah,
he thinks
yes,
I can do two things at once. I'm not like you. I'll have a look at that later, Vin. Thanks.
He's basically referring to a picture, I think, of a newspaper article which showed somebody waving a wad of what passes for currency, and the quote was, "Printing company updates paper thing that controls your entire life." Posing as satire, but the best satire is really close to truth, I think. So,
it is, yeah.
Great
very,
post.
Very close.
Yeah.
So this court ruled, anyway, High Court ruled that they were entitled to do this and all this kind of thing. And I think that came about because perhaps they weren't asking the right questions. So they went in and they asked a set of questions and they thought they all had all things covered. But for me, I think that maybe they didn't ask pertinent questions, which is the problem when you go into court. If, you know, you can't go into court assuming that a judge understands all of what we're talking about here. If a judge asks you your name, you give your name, etc., etc. If they ask you, where are you drinking or whatever, you say either yes or no, or guilty or not guilty. You know, they're direct questions and they have to be a specific answer, or vice versa. They're not going to give an opinion on what might be happening elsewhere. They will just answer directly the question that you ask.
So is the High Court not there to establish the actual fairness and humanity of the situation then?
Well, if I ask you about how to grow potatoes, you know, you're not going to tell me about turnips, you know.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how they kind of close ranks, you know. They close ranks in that way, so it has to be very specific, because if it's too detailed, it wanders off into, it's like the rabbit hole that we all know of, the rabbit holes that we deal with here in the station and the internet and all that kind of stuff. So
you can end up following like a will-o'-the-wisp, like a light in the bogs.
It's fraught with danger. However, it's been chipped away at slowly but surely, day by day, week by week, month by month. At the moment, there's a kind of a moratorium, which is, to me, is highly susceptible, or not susceptible, suspicious, because we're due an election here in this country now. Within, it could be called next week, for next month, or for January or February. And most people who are going into court now with the official offer, or maybe not with it, it's been put down the road for 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, until after the election. And I think that's scandalous. It's great for the people, and we're not going to complain about it, because it's good for those people who will stay in their homes for another 6 months, at least. But at the same time, to me, it's political interference when these people are supposed to be so the pillars of society, and everything is supposed to be, you know, the I's dotted and the T's crossed and everything else. Yet, to me, that's just political interference.
Does make you think if it was a fair system, presumably they wouldn't be too worried about having it running up to an election.
Exactly. And they don't want to deal with it. They don't want to be the ones, although we had what we call here the tarnished, which would be the Vice Prime Minister, saying only last week that anybody who goes in and pays what they can, the banks will look favourably on them, which essentially is telling people about the official offer without using that term, you know.
So is officialdom kind of catching up with this as a technique?
Well, I think the problem is so large that they can't be seen to be doing certain things, because it opens a can of worms, and nobody wants to be the one that opens those can of worms. And that's the impression that I get. I could be totally wrong.
I have a suspicion that these are special metal-eating worms and they're eating their way out of the tin anyway.
So if I've got
to grips with this official offer, if I try using it, am I inevitably going to end up in court? He says the man at the bar somewhat nervously.
Yes, very possibly. In all cases, more than likely you will, yes.
Mm-hmm.
However, at the moment, okay, if you want to go through the man at the bar thing, it would be good if you want to start at the beginning, let's say, because there are certain things that we come across all the time, certain questions that people ask. You know, so let's say you're at the bar, we're at the bar now, and we start this conversation, and you're telling me that you're a bit behind on your mortgage or something like that. So if you want to start there before we go down to the end product.
Yep, that sounds good to me. So how is it that I end, what's the process that I end up in court with, and what's the difference between them just taking me to court and taking my house off me?
That's two or three questions.
Yeah.
Well, they are trying to take your house from you, because somewhere in the original contract, wherever that is, it probably says if a default occurs, which, you know, that could mean an interpretation of missing 1 month's payment, 2 months' payment, 3 months' payment, whatever, you know. So let's say you're in that position and you're going everywhere and people are saying to you, oh, look, there's nothing you can do. You might as well just, if you can't afford to pay your house, just hand the keys and all the rest of it, which we're telling people not to do, simply because you can do the official offer. And the official offer is called the official offer because it had to be called something. And it's called official because you actually write it down on paper in your own handwriting, and which legitimizes it, which gives it just official, if you know what I'm saying. So you get your letter, and they're saying, oh, default has occurred. We want you out of your home, blah, blah, blah. Now, what are your options? Well, if you can't afford to pay all the money at the moment, and people ask questions like, well, will the interest accrue? Well, the fact is that you can't afford to pay what they want you to pay at this particular time. So whether you do the official offer or whether you don't, interest will accrue. You know, because they love the interest. That's what they love.
Yeah.
And this is part of the biggest problem of the whole thing. As you mentioned earlier on, that people didn't know that they were going to pay three times back for the money that they so-called supposedly have borrowed. Right? So, the official offer is about contract law. And contract law has seven elements in it. And the first one is offer. Second is acceptance. Consideration. Performance. Intention. Capacity. And lawfulness. Okay?
Yeah.
So, let's say they want £1,000 a month off you. But you only have 500 to give them. Okay. Well, if you can afford 500, give them the 500. Okay? And you can do it in the form of that, the official offer. And when you do it like that, you're making them an offer. Now, I'll just go through the basics first. You make them the offer, they accept it. And they might write back and say, we don't accept it. Very rarely they send it back. Sometimes they send it back. Sometimes they don't. More often than not, their whole idea is to get money, you know.
But if I've signed a contract with them, why don't they just send it back and say, look, just give us the money?
Well, that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, even though that you've probably sold it off to a dozen other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, they're saying, you owe us this money, you've signed this contract, blah, 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 and terms and conditions, blah, blah, blah. This is what you signed up to. And everybody says, okay, that's what I signed up to. The reality of it is, people don't know what they signed up to. Because when they went in to their solicitor's office, the contract wasn't read out. You didn't ask for the contract to be read out because, simply because, we trusted these people. And we said, well, these people know what they're doing. And we didn't think that there was any questions to ask. Because if you go back through the years, and we all must remember, in case we forget, that nobody knew anything about mortgage contracts up until 2008, really understood them in any shape or make. The ordinary man on the street trusted the solicitor to say, everything's okay here, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So that's what you thought you were. You were getting that safety valve, you know. However, the reality of it was that they don't even read these contracts. They're only standard contracts that you learn in college. I was told that by my solicitor. So we have all these assumptions about what's going on. And, you know, the mortgage situation in Ireland wasn't that prevalent until maybe the 80s. You know, the worst middle-class people were getting mortgages. The working-class people weren't getting mortgages. They were being housed by the state mostly, etc., etc., you know. And then that dried up and people had to get mortgages and they had to find out about them. And then when you go in and ask for a mortgage, and a mortgage in a bank is just like a product. It's like Coke. It could be a large Coke or a small Coke, or a Coke with a different sort of essence in it or something like that, a Diet Coke or whatever. So the banks make up these products, and that's how they make money. They keep making different products. So that's why you have the variable mortgages and you have the straightforward ones. And then they go and change the interest rates, which you have no control over. So you could start out with a mortgage of 3% interest, which could rise to 16%, because the first mortgage I had, I got a bridging loan for a year on 16% interest. Whether you have enough money in that entitles you, that qualifies you to take out a so-called loan or a mortgage agreement. So it changes every couple of years. Maybe I'm going off track a bit.
You could, just having your interest taken up, being at 16%, could very easily make it impossible to pay. Just that in itself.
Absolutely.
So over 25 years, that would be an awful, awful, awful lot of money.
That's the way it works.
Six or seven times, possibly even more, the value of the house, just roughly in my head.
That's it.
Wow.
As I say, there's no other way of doing it. There isn't. I don't know of any other way of doing it. So everybody, even people today now, are going in and taking out mortgages today. And even with all this going on, they probably even don't know what they're actually taking on.
Mm-hmm.
And generally what people do is, you know, the mortgage company or building society will say, we've approved you, you know, that approval thing, which means that you have stated that you can pay this back and you're earning so much and you've saved so much to prove that you can actually pay this, you know, all these conditions prior to this. And they make it all look so like going to school and doing your final exams in school, you know, another rite of passage in the way of life.
I've entered this contract. I thought I was just borrowing money, but I've entered a contract and I can no longer live up to it, or perform, perhaps is the word, as I expected. And I guess what we're suggesting here is that we're enabled to modify the contract, are we? We can say, well, look, I need to do something different.
Exactly.
Hmm.
That's essentially what we're doing, is we're modifying it. They won't turn around and say, oh, that's fantastic, John, thanks very much, good lad, you know. They're going to fight tooth and nail for what they think they have entitlement to. So the seven elements are, as I say, offer, acceptance, consideration, performance, intention, capacity, and lawfulness. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, so you make an offer and they accept it. Now, there's different ways of doing it. We go this way. You can also always just go into your local bank and pay off a certain amount of money, or just give it into the teller. But that situation isn't prevailing these days, because most of the banks are not the banks that they were, and most of the people who have mortgages with these people, vulture funds, they have no offices or no tellers or anything that you can go in and do these things with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so it's either done by direct debit through a banking system to go to these people or whatever. You could go in initially and just slip the money to the teller and then get your receipt and then produce the receipts in court. It's the same thing, except this way it's written down. When they receive it, if they put it in to your account or off whatever numbers, magic numbers they have, they're accepting it. But they will never say that they're accepting it. But they have it. It's like if I owe you 100 quid and I say, look at you. There you go, Nick, there's a tenner. And you say, I've only a tenner. And you say, okay, I'll take that. And you put it in your pocket. Well, that's offer and acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yeah.
It's a kind of, that's a verbal agreement. The other way is a tacit agreement. It doesn't have to be verbal. It doesn't have to be in writing. However, it's best to have it in writing because you can produce this in court.
Yes.
And it's a simple method. So if we go through the seven elements, anyway. So we have offer and acceptance. So consideration. The consideration, that's where you can look that word up. You know, that could mean, let's say, I'll let you in to this for a certain consideration. So they're making that term or whatever that price is, that consideration. But you're giving them some consideration. Performance, well, they can't say that there's a default because you're performing. You're not performing the way they want you to, but you are performing. So there's four of the items on the seven that we've covered with the official offer. The fifth is intention. So in court, it shows that you didn't walk away from it, that your intention is to pay, but you haven't got the facility to pay the way they want you to pay at this point in time. Capacity is next. And the capacity is, do you have the capacity to do that at this particular time? Well, you're writing it down and saying, I've looked at my accounts and this is the maximum that I can pay you each month.
So it's important that you're telling the truth at that point and that you have robust figures from which to work.
Sure. Well, you see, there is another structure here in Ireland, and it's called the MABS process. Money Advice Bureau Services, which they're installing into the courts as we speak. They're in all the courts now. So if someone goes up, the judges are finding that they're going to be lenient with somebody and say, look, tell you what, John, you go down and talk to MABS. So what the Money Advice Bureau Service does is they ask you, well, how much does it cost you for your electricity, your gas, fuel, food, clothing, you know, all those lists of things, car insurance, car tax, TV licenses, TVs, electrics, washing machines, whatever, you know. And there's a million things that you could put on that list. And there are probably a million things that you've forgotten that you do, like actually having to get a haircut, you know, which is going to cost you 10 quid or whatever it is nowadays, you know. Yeah. So all these things add up. But they will go through with a fine-tooth comb. Not so much MABS, but if you go to the bank, they will go through it. They have been in the early days, 5 years ago, they were sitting in people's kitchens telling them to buy cheaper tea bags and cheaper nappies for the babies and don't buy makeup and all this sort of stuff, you know.
The representatives of the banks were saying that to people?
Yes.
Wow. And do they expect you to present receipts for all of this stuff?
Not necessarily, no.
Okay.
You could do it for your gas bill and your ESB bill, the essentials, you know.
Yeah.
But you're not going to keep your receipts from your shop or whatever.
Mm.
But you could, you know. People do it in business, don't they? They keep receipts for their diesel and their petrol and get it offset for their taxes and stuff like that. And of course the last one is lawfulness. Well, you see, not only is this legal, but it's also lawful because they are the seven elements of the of contract law. So you're offering something, and they're accepting it. They're letting on they're not accepting it. And another thing is to remember, they can't refuse it.
Okay, so they are actually accepting it, but they're trying to tell you that they're not, and they're not actually allowed not to accept it. How is that? That sounds like a pretty bizarre situation. How has that come about?
Well, it goes back to what the situation with wards, you know?
Yeah.
They don't use the word refuse, but they will use it, words like unacceptable, unsustainable, deemed to be inoperable, unsustainable, everything. But they can't use the word refuse. If they use the word refuse, you can just walk out there and say, bye-bye, thanks very much.
That sounds like a bit of magic.
You won't get them to say refuse.
Right.
You won't get them to say refuse.
And presumably if they returned your offer, they would also be refusing, which is why they keep hold of it.
Yeah, these are poker players of the highest order. These are very clever people. They know how to play on your emotions. They know how to play on your brain. They know that you're not used to looking at legalese writing. They know all this sort of stuff. You know, so what they might do is send it all back to you and say, look, I'll tell you what. Oh, well, they're not accepting it. You see? Well, in that case, you could write to them and say, are you refusing? In which case, they will not. They won't answer that question.
Okay.
They write back and say, it's unacceptable, etc. I got a letter, first letter back to say, is this what you're willing to pay or what you can afford to pay? Something like that it was. It was like a trick question.
Yeah. You know?
And that was just returned to sender. I didn't answer them in any way, shape or make. And so that's what we're relying on here, seven elements of contract law. And they don't want you to know and me to know and that other fella beside us in the bar who's just going to order another drink now, they don't want them to know that we can actually change this contract. If they can change it, we can change it.
And they can change it because they're changing interest rates and things like that, and the scope, and all sorts of other things. And because
they're doing even worse things. They're conning people with a 5-year tax interest free. You know, interest only. It's never interest free. Interest only. All this sort of stuff. You know, more magic and more pieces of trickery that'll be good. We get 6 months out of this. And, so 6 months is nothing in any time, you know. People generally, let's be honest about it, people generally buy a house and they live in it most of their lives, you know, depending on their circumstances. In general, the majority of the populations in any country, that's what happens, you know. And nobody ever takes out a mortgage with the intent of not paying it, you know, absolutely not. They've already been put through the hoops to be accepted in order to get this, and I won't go into the fact that you don't actually get the money anyway. So that's another day's work.
Rob's put a question into the chat book. He's put, do refuse and reject have different meanings?
They do.
So they're trying not to refuse it. Are they trying not to reject it as well?
That's a very good question, Rob. Plenty of guys there now that will give you the etymology of those particular words. Reject, yeah, they can reject it for now, you know what I mean? But a refusal is just a point-blank refusal.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Makes sense to me. It does. And the other thing that interests me is you said you're actually handwriting it. I mean, I'm not sure we've got a pen in our house. We've been doing emails and transmitting stuff using the computer. You're still writing with a biro.
Oh, we're writing with an old biro over here. Should be jizz, like we're very posh over here with biros.
Wow. And why have you chosen to do it that way? Are you part of a kind of Luddite clan that's not using keyboards, or is there a good reason for using your own handwriting?
Not at all, no. The handwriting thing is very personal. it's in your handwriting and you're signing it by colon at the end of it. It's very official. It's to me, it's much more personal than an email or typing something, you know.
And does it demonstrate that it actually comes from a living flesh and blood individual rather than just sort of, you know?
Well, it certainly does. Because not only are you writing it on that, but you're copying, not copying it. What's the other word? You're using the blue sheets to transfer it onto
things. The carbon. You're using carbon paper as well as a biro.
Oh, absolutely.
Excellent. So you're making a facsimile.
There you go. The better word for it, fax. exactly. And you can send them either the top copy or the second copy or the third copy or whatever you want to send them. It doesn't really matter. Some people spend a lot of time musing over whether I send the top copy or send the copy, the facsimile or whatever. Just send it. It doesn't matter. You already have a copy. It's true to your writing. It can't be adjusted. It can't be anything. It is what it is, you know. But it makes it personal and it makes it very official. There's nothing better than handwriting, and I'll tell you why. Because what's happening nowadays is that when you get a letter from the solicitors or any solicitors company these days, they don't sign them anymore. They're afraid to sign them. They sign them, let's say there's a particular company that we rang up, they're called Beauchamps, spelled Beauchamps but pronounced Beauchamps.
Yeah,
and it's signed Beauchamps. So we did a little phone call. Well, actually, Vin did, and asked to speak to Beauchamps, and he said, "Oh, there's no such person as Beauchamps. It's a company, you know, the rest of it." So to me, that says that something in writing, handwritten by the person, is very significant.
Yeah,
one way or the other, you know.
If they did want to sign their documents, would there be any advantage in them signing them BY colon?
Well, they don't have to do that as far as I know. But let's say if they sign their name at a particular thing, then you can reference it directly to that person.
Okay. So you've got a handle on a real human being, as it were, instead of just a company.
Yeah, because they could turn around and say, well, John McCann signed this, so you better talk to him about it if it really got nasty.
So given that the solicitors and people who apparently know what they're doing are too nervous to sign these documents, shouldn't we feel a similar nervousness?
No, I think that's their problem.
Right.
Really, that's their problem. I mean, for centuries we wrote to each other, you know. It's only in the last few years that it's all become technology.
Yeah.
You know. And they still ask for your signature on things, though. You know, sign this, please. Sign that. Sign this. Sign that. They actually transfer your signature off a piece of paper and put it onto your license, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And all this types of thing, you know, which they can do with contracts, I presume, as well.
And does signing BY colon make a difference to that process in some way?
I think it firmly says that this is from the man, you know, as you say, flesh, blood, man, and no doubt who signed it, etc., etc.
Whereas if you just write the signature, it might be from your corporate entity.
Well, there is the corporate entity. We won't go into the corporate entity thing and that, because that's only confuses the issue.
True, yeah. Fair point.
See, that's one of the rabbit holes that prevents people from performing or doing the official offer.
Taking their eye off the ball, getting a bit distracted.
Exactly.
So you were saying that one of the ways we could put this thing in is through a teller, but that's getting a little bit more difficult. So can you do it via the post?
Oh, well, I would do it via the post, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You know, the wording of the letter itself is very, very simple. There's actually two letters. I'll read the second one. So what it is, you know, official offer at the top of the page to the company that's claiming that you owe them money from yourself, the address to operate on account number, the account number that they're giving you, whatever your maximum you can afford to pay, pounds or euros, affected monthly. Now, this is for somebody who has switched their mortgage, this is another company, pending verified obligation of such performance as satisfaction on all accounts, demands, stroke, obligations. That's the wording, nothing else. Signed by your name, dated. And that's it. And with that, you do get a check or a postal order, and what you do is you attach that to the letter. Not by a piece of thing, not but staple it to the letter. On the back page of that letter, or the reverse of that page, you write across it from left to right, bottom to top, official offer, and underline it, or overline it, whatever way you like. Mm. And the reason for that is, if it goes into an office, and someone has this particular page in their hand, and someone flips it over, and there's nothing written on the back of it, you know, they may say that they didn't get it, or they're losing it, or somebody puts it somewhere. But if they flip it over, they'll see official offer written on it, so that makes it another document to keep.
Oh, that's tricksy of them, isn't it? To choose to look at the blank side and believe that there's nothing there.
Well, you could go to court and the judge is given the papers, you know. And he probably has a million papers there, and he might just flip it over and he's looking at a blank page, or she's looking at a blank page, you know.
Mm.
But if it says official offer across it, it just tells them, okay, this is an important piece of paper,
okay,
particularly to deal with this case, as it were. So it's a safeguard. It doesn't have to be done, but it's a safeguard. We're trying to make sure that everything is in order.
Yeah.
In case of any other eventualities.
And to the somewhat archaic use of biros and carbon paper, we can also add a stapler now. None of those nice, colourful, shiny, plastic-covered paper clips or anything. It's got to be physically attached, has it?
Physically attached to it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's another reason for that. I can't remember the reason for it, but it makes it it makes it a whole thing, you know.
Yeah.
And then when they take it out, they can't say that they didn't get the postal order or check, because there's two pinholes there marking the staple.
Okay.
Or if they copy it, put it through a photocopier with the staple marks out of it, you can see that and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So, so in this case, an enclosure is different from an attachment. It's important that they get to remove this attachment.
Absolutely.
Because I guess under no circumstances will they send you the money back.
They could. They might do that, but and keep the letter, you know,
mm-hmm.
And say we're not accepting it, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And
but
so,
but they've accepted the letter by keeping it.
Well, they'll try these things on, you see. They know that if they send that money back, and I'm telling you and our friend here in the bar as well, and he comes down the next week and he says, I'm after sending that away, and they're after sending the money back to me. And he's in an awful state. That's a load of nonsense. That's a load of crap. That doesn't work.
Mm.
You see? It's a game. And they play these games, and they're excellent at these games. This is what our profession is about, some of it.
And all you do with that is just send it back to them. You've made your offer, and they now need to take on their responsibilities with regard to the offer. So you don't do anything else to it. You return it to sender with our other special sticker.
Well, if you think of it further on down the road, and you go into court, and you say you sent it, and you attach the check to the letter, but they sent the check back to you. So you can say, are you refusing it? That's the big question. Are you refusing it?
And they will do all sorts of wriggling to make sure that they don't actually do that.
Send it back to them. They know either it's a kind of a test. They're going to test you all the way through it.
Yeah.
By doing that sort of thing, it's like a game of poker, as I say. I raise you, the stakes are getting higher here. No, put it back to that person and they'll probably relent and just say, oh, here, I can't be dealing with all this sort of thing, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, it does seem a bit strange that they're obliged in the long run. Even if they try sending it back to you and you return it to them, they are one way or the other obliged to accept this payment, and it's recognised as legal and lawful that you're performing on the contract to whatever extent you can afford to do so. So how come, under those circumstances, it ends up in court so often, as you're saying?
Well, simply because in the original contract, there's always a default, you know. Default has a court.
Okay.
Which could mean some banks, it could be one payment you missed. Some banks could be six payments. Some could be a little bit more lenient, etc. They might try and get you to pay it back. Most people would, before the collapse, let's say, people would say, look, I'll pay an extra few bob over the next few months to cover what I owe. All those little things were going on, you know, but it's a different situation now because the money tap has been turned off and everybody's situation has changed through no fault of their own, really, you know.
Yeah.
However, you are performing, which is part of the contract, you know, and your intention is very much to keep performing. Your capacity is not what it was, you know, but you're still performing and your intent is to still perform. They can't argue with that. They will try. They will try and shift you from that position by the use of their magic words and by their attitude towards you in the court. And from what I hear, these people's attitude towards people in the court is absolutely abominable. They might pick it up on the corner and wave it and say, this is a paltry amount that's being offered here, you know. All this sort of thing. Everything to do you down and to make you feel like a worm. I was trying to worm the way out of paying, you know.
This sounds like a confidence trick, John.
Very much so. But that's, I suppose you could say, is part of it. And when everything is going fine, nobody knows these things. You know, if the water, the money tap is still rolling and we're going on and we're paying our way, which we intend to do, then we don't know these. We don't have a problem with these things. You know, the fact it's kind of obvious that in Ireland now there's 50,000 to 100,000 mortgages in arrears.
Wow.
That's without the people who've already been, their homes have been taken away from them. And we've only got a population of 4 million here, 4.5 million, maybe 5 million.
Hmm.
And if you take the age differences and you bring down the different demographics, a lot of our young people are in Australia or America, Canada, whatever else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people retiring, semi-retired, coming to that age. And then we have children up to 20, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We have a large population of a young population. So the actual workforce is diminished considerably. So that hence, it's a contracting thing. So it's not just a case of John doesn't want to pay his mortgage. No, there's 50,000 other people who can't, or 100,000 people. And the suicide rate is phenomenal. All sorts of things going on. So obviously it's not just an ordinary situation. It hadn't happened like this before 2008, but it happened in 2008 onwards, simply because all our money is going to pay back an odious debt to... you know.
Yeah, more and more of our money is disappearing in other ways to other things.
Yeah.
So a question came from Keith in the chat box as we were chatting away there, saying, is a loan ever fully payable with an official offer? And some people were saying yes and some people were saying no. What do you reckon?
Well, of course it is.
Yeah.
It might take hundreds of years, but there you go.
And does it make any difference if you reach the end of the term of your contract and you're still paying what you can afford to pay? Does that make any difference?
Well, they would probably say, look, it's a 25-year contract or a 15-year contract, you know, and all of those things. But that was in the good times, you know. It's not the same now. But you're still performing, you know, and if you're performing and if you pop your clogs, there's no reason why your children, if you're looking to have children or whatever, and they want to continue it, they can do it. If I pop my clogs tomorrow, it's a problem for my children. Or maybe not a problem for them. They may not want to do with it. But in that case, the bank takes the house back.
Yeah.
So the bank can never lose. You know.
It is a puzzle to me that one way or the other, the bank ends up really in nominal possession of practically all the property that's not owned by the aristocracy, because nearly everything else is under a mortgage. And even if it's paid for, it'll go under a mortgage when the next person comes and tries to use it as a dwelling.
Yeah, it's a perpetual thing, isn't it?
So in the end, it's not just 100,000 people who might be in trouble. Effectively, everybody is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I noticed we didn't have a chat, but you wrote to me and said that you've been talking to a few people lately who are getting very concerned, and I take it by that. You weren't hearing as much of it maybe last year or the year before or whatever.
No.
You're hearing now, you know.
Yeah, absolutely true. Absolutely true. But I am also finding more people who are already fairly knowledgeable about these subjects. Not only are they talking about them, they are starting to realise there's something they can do.
Yeah, and this is part of my mission in life, is to tell them about the official offer.
Yes. Yes.
That's, you know, I seem to be wearing that cap these days, but I think it's a good cap to be wearing. And people say, okay, the interest might accrue and all the rest of it. But if you haven't got the money, it's going to accrue anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, all these things are going to happen if you can't afford to pay. It doesn't matter. If you're not going to do the official offer, you're still in that predicament. However, the official offer, even though you will end up in court, but the time span is greatly different than the people who don't do the official offer.
Okay, you know? So you end up in court a lot more quickly if you don't engage with the system in some sense.
Absolutely.
So
paying it totally, they'll say, okay, right, no, you haven't got a case. You might think you have a case, and you'll have people telling you, oh, well, they didn't get the money in the first place. And all of these things that we now know how this system actually works.
But none of that makes any difference.
Well, you're not going into court to prove anything like that. You're only in court for, you know, let's say you're in court for speeding. You're not in court for no tax. You're in court for speeding. So it doesn't matter what you know about the car you're driving or anything about law or common law or any other law or anything. You're in for a specific reason, and you can't go in there and say, oh, well, I didn't really get the money in the first place because the banking system works like this, and it's all a trick, and it's this, that, and the other. Ain't going to listen to that.
Well, you've been behaving like the money's real for quite some time by that point anyway, haven't you, I guess?
Well, if it's the same people that you took it out with originally, that argument doesn't apply.
Right, okay, yeah. We've got a question from Delamitri. Saying, is not renegotiation as circumstances change part of every contract?
That's what we're finding out. This is what they didn't want us to know. That's what they don't want the public at large to know. And they're safeguarding that bit of knowledge. But in actual fact, it's an offer and acceptance on both sides. And as far as I can read it, is there's a responsibility from the lender, just as much as there is a responsibility from the borrower.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why it says in the great book, neither a lender, a borrower, nor a lender be.
Nice and even-handed, that one.
But everybody says, oh, it just means borrowing. No, neither a borrower nor a lender be.
So what happens if you... Do you think it would make a difference if you were fortunate enough to discover about this process before you'd failed to make some payments? So, say, because what we're saying is that sometimes people have missed 1, 2, 3, 4 months before they kind of re-engage. What if if you managed to sort out the official offer before you actually defaulted, i.e. paid no money at all for one of your payments, do you think that would make a difference to your likelihood of getting dragged into court?
Probably not.
Probably not. So ultimately it's not the default that's the problem, they just want you in court.
But no, if you've been performing, it's when you stop paying them, then all of a sudden you come under their radar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're paying them something, it's less likelihood that you come under. They cherry pick. So on their computer screens, we have, I don't know how many they'd have, thousands, let's say. And the ones who aren't paying, they come up big, you know, warning, 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 warning. But the people who are paying something, they're on a different scale, a different tier, let's say,
yeah,
of the action that these so-called lenders have to take.
Yeah.
And so it's going to cost them money to take action. So they're going to cherry pick. And the easy ones are the ones who don't pay anything at all. That's easy. That's a no-brainer.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. So they're picking their targets.
Yeah. And they eventually down to the people who are doing the official offer.
Yeah.
But that could take a year. In my case now, it's going on 4 years now or something, you know.
Yeah. So have you had to have several goes in court or what?
I haven't been to court yet.
Right. So there you go. That's a bit of a demonstration of what you were suggesting earlier, that there's a huge difference in the time it takes to get them into court. If you're not performing, they can have you straight in there, but as long as you're performing to a degree, life becomes a lot more difficult.
Yeah, I'm still in my home, my dwelling. They are taking me to court, probably sooner rather than later at this point. So I have to learn then how to perform myself when I'm in court.
Yeah.
But that's another day's work.
Yeah.
But if you do the official offer, then you can find out how you're going to handle it when you get to court.
Mm-hmm.
So then the knowledge of the seven elements of contract law, you're up to date on it and you can use it. You can object to some of the bullshit that they're coming across with. You can steer it. You know, it's not easy, but it can be done. And we have people doing it at this point in time. And all the people that I know, there are currently in court cases, besides the election sort of mandate thing, as all have been put down for another 6 months perhaps, and all the rest of it, which gives those people another few months to talk to others and say, I'm going into court, what will I do, what will I say?
Mm-hmm. Well, Vin, there's a chap a bit called Vin a bit further down the bar who offered earlier on that the official offer means that you don't have to fear going to court. Which sounds great. Do you think we could maybe after a music break talk a little bit about the court process?
Do you think we've covered enough detail on the official offer itself? Because I'll tell you why. Yeah, of course we can. However, I'm sort of anxious that the people in the UK, America and all the other countries actually take this on board. You know, I kind of get worried, anxious for other people who are going through these processes.
Yes.
And number one detail is we don't charge for this. You know, it's not a money-making racket. It's not anything like it. And we have a site, Official Offer Made Simple, that has all the details. It has the seven elements of contract. It has the letters in it. It has responses from banks. It has all sorts of things. So we can discuss that after. Are we going to play a good track now, Doc?
Well, I'll do my best. I know that's pretty rare, that is. We've got, before it kind of disappears out the top of the chat box, let's have another question from Dell. He says, can John expand on how it brings a man closer to Christ to honour his commitments? Have you got one for that?
I'm a radio host, I'm not a preacher.
Excellent, yes indeed, yeah. And having watched Graham's excellent link called Caesar's Messiah, the Roman conspiracy to invent Jesus, I think that probably is also a question for an entire 3-hour show all of its own, Dell. So yeah, I will. What I'm going to do, John, we've got about 6 or 7 minutes of music lined up, and I'm going to kick off with Hawkwind doing a bit of old style rhythm and blues. So it's a track called "Dealing with the Devil." So I'll bung that on, and we'll be back in 5 or 6 minutes, folks. You've been listening to Dr. Rock chatting with John McCann about the official offer, possibly one of the best solutions on the table currently. In fact, I'd say probably. And here's Hawkwind, "Dealing with the Devil," because that's what's happening. There we go, Screaming Miss Jackson and the Slap Your Mama Big Band. And was I drunk? Probably. So you're back with us, John.
I'm still here.
Very good, mate, very good. Well, I know we figure there's some more things that we need to be looking at before we get to the point where we're actually drug into one of their courts. We were talking during the break there about pending verification of obligation on the letter that you read out, which is to go with an official offer where somebody's done the switcheroo on your mortgage and it's no longer being run by the people that you originally contracted with. What are we asking them to do there?
Document and verify the obligation. They are three very powerful words. They don't need anything added to them or taken away from. Document, that means that they have to produce an actual contract with them and verify that contract and what they're saying is verifiable in law in association with what they're saying are our obligations.
Right.
And it covers everything. Document, verify the obligation.
But from what we've said so far, it doesn't sound like under these circumstances where the mortgage has been sold on or whatever, they shouldn't have a contract that they can produce. Doesn't that hold them up a bit?
Well, these are so nefarious that written in the original contracts probably said that they may sell it on to somebody or shall sell it on to somebody, you know, which you, 99 out of 100 times, weren't privy to that kind of information because you didn't think it was going to be necessary to know these things, and your solicitor is not going to go through every sentence with you and explain the law aspect of it. And when everything is running smoothly, it doesn't come into play.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when things go awry that they depend on these little words, default, may, shall, all these things. And they're usually those little words in a sentence. And you'll find some other sentences in it that might even sort of contradict that kind of thing. So they are going on this, that it's lawful for them to you to pay them all this money. And not only that, but they can sell it on to somebody else, which then it becomes their problem and not theirs. So they're making money out of you from the beginning, and then they're selling it, and they can buy it back and sell it again. And it's all on stock markets and all these things that are called derivatives and securitization, which are just products that the banking system made up.
It's amazing how they seem to be turning debt into investment.
Exactly.
That's a clever trick too.
Well, you see, the real problem I have with all that is that might be all very good and might be even lawful and it might be whatever in their eyes, except there's only one thing that really disgusts me about the whole thing is that I can't go onto the stock market and buy a whole heap of mortgages, nor neither can you. But if you set yourself up as some sort of finance asset management company and deal in the stock exchange, you can do it. And then you can go in and say, I'll get that a £200,000 mortgage or £100,000 mortgage for pennies on the pound, and they buy it for 10 grand or whatever, you know. And even if they don't, if they buy 100 and they terrify 99 of those people and get the 100 grand back for their 10 grand, they're in huge profit. But it's not accessible to the person who's the mortgage holder. And I don't think that is lawful. But then that's company law and trickery and shadow banking and all that sort of stuff.
Yes. So what other things do we... Dal's very kindly put in officialoffermadesimple.com, which is where people can read about all of this. But I'm aware that there's several people out there, and I'm one of them, I think, that find it a lot easier to hear people talking about things than I do necessary to read them. But it's the Official Offer Made Simple is a fabulous site. It's very easy to understand and has been, I think, beautifully designed. But what do you think of the other major things we should be aware of when we're offering up something like this to these pirates?
Well, not only that, but there are people that they can talk to. You know, we're all available to actually speak to as well. You know, they can get us through the site itself, whatever. And any questions, they can be asked either through the chat box or private messages or whatever, one-to-one. We do that as well. We do that through in Cork, it's through the head school, and you know, the main man deals with this with people mostly every day. Most of us come in contact with people every day, and where people are calling us and we put it to them, they make up their own minds. In all cases, the person themselves have to make up their mind on it themselves. We don't call it advice. We don't call it a load of things. It's a remedy that is going to give you more time so you can learn more about the law and how to deal with things in court. And it keeps you in good stead lawfully, because you're performing and your intention is to perform, which is hugely important. So it gives you an extra, you know, it's like... you've an extra card in the pack, as it were, whatever way you explain that analogy. And it works in any country. This is the beauty of it. You know, it doesn't have to be common law, this law, because it's contract law. Whether it's whatever course they deem to be specialists in, it's contract law, and that's all. It's a civil matter. It's not a criminal matter. So you don't need to know all about common law, what other laws or all the other sort of things that they come up with.
And in this, I guess, in this commercial world, everything then is a matter of contract.
Yeah, everything is.
And every offer that's made to us, we can make a counter-offer.
Yeah, insofar as if I say, do you want a cup of tea? And you say, yes or no. That's an offer, acceptance, or, you know, whatever. And everything is an offer. Nearly everything, if you think about it. A business is offering you their service. Whether you take it up or not is up to you. You know, so in a sense, nearly everything is that contracting thing, you know.
And whenever we use the words document and verify, we're requiring them to produce whatever contract it is they believe themselves to be operating under.
Yep. And they try to avoid that, of course.
Yeah.
Because what they do when they get to court is they say that, this man's performing, but it's a paltry amount, let's say. You know. So that's why it's very important that you do your sums and say, well, I'm going to give them the maximum. Now, that maximum, depending on your circumstances, varies between person to person. You know.
Yeah.
And I'm going to use that word person to person, even though it's a no-no word on people's internet radio. I know all those things.
You're safe here, mate.
For the point of this exercise, it's common parlance, you know. So you're putting yourself in good stead. And the problem is, as I said to you during the break, is that we're sitting in a bar now and we're having a pint and there's another guy listening to us and he's looking at us and he's saying, you know, this guy, he doesn't look like a solicitor. He doesn't look like a barrister. He doesn't speak with marbles in his mouth. He doesn't have figures after his name, letters after his name, and all this kind of thing. How can I trust this man? And all this kind of thing. And that's the obvious thing that people say. How would he know anything about anything?
Well, the thing is, I guess, you know, we were all in that position, weren't we? We were all in a position where all of the information we were getting was coming from apparently orthodox sources. And, I mean, you know, when I first discovered all of this, I did feel a bit like Alice at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. We got...
Yeah, I just took a lease.
Yeah. Can John explain, verify, the second part of that sentence, and why that word is chosen instead of clarify? What are the subtle differences in context? Thank you, Lee.
Good question.
Thanks, John, for being there to answer that one.
Okay. To clarify, you can clarify something and say, this is whatever, but to verify it, it kind of puts a stamp on it, doesn't it?
Right. Yep. Yeah,
clarify something is to suggest, well, A, let's clarify the situation. You took out a contract, you did this, and you did that. That's clarification of a situation. But the verification of whether that actually happened or not has to come in the form of something that's written and stamped and legit.
Yeah, I think verify is based in veritas, isn't it? To make true, to make real.
Mm-hmm. That's the best I can come up with, Lee.
Sure, that's good enough for me. And these words, using exactly these words is important, isn't it? You emphasised that earlier on when we were talking about the the actual letter of offer. The actual words have been worked on very, very hard and modified over time, haven't they?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's been honed, let's say, to this specifics to keep it simple. And to keep it direct, and it's asking the questions that need to be asked. And those three words can be used. Let's say you want to ask the tax man to document and verify the obligation to pay tax.
bet he doesn't like that.
Exactly. So there's no need to go into a whole, let's say, freeman situation where you're detailing too many things, too many aspects to too many chances or situations that can easily be nobbled, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's very concise, I suppose. Concise and direct.
And it's simple and it's generally applicable. That's what I quite like about it. It means you don't have to remember lots and lots of different things for different circumstances. It's an all-round... good requirement to place on them, isn't it?
You're putting the headache back into their court, as it were.
Yes. Yeah. Which is, after all, the idea of the game.
Exactly. Exactly. So the choices are, this other guy that's sitting with us at the bar listening and is in trouble, and he's thinking, well, should I do this or should I give it a chance? Well, I would say yes, obviously. And I can say yes because I'm actually doing it. You know, so that is the guarantee we're talking about. Experience, real life experience here. Number one, I'm not selling anything to anybody. I don't want anything for what I do. That might change because we have to be very careful that we don't get people who just do not want it. They think it's a little neat trick to get out of something, you know? So we're looking for genuine people who were genuinely in need of this remedy to sustain them, maybe perhaps save their lives. That sounds, I don't know what that sounds like, but it is a fact.
Yeah.
Not just something picked out of the air. It has saved people's lives because it has bought them time. It has given them time to actually learn more about what we're talking about. They're not coming on and saying, because most of what we talk about on People's Internet Radio, it takes about 2 years for it to sink in.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with people in a dreadful situation who are terrified, absolutely terrified. But I can tell you this, somebody brought it up, I think it was Rob, brought it up earlier in the chat box. Now, the fact, when you sit down, something very strange happens. You sit down and you pick up that biro and you put it onto paper and you write out this letter and you put your postal order or your cheque or whatever way you're going to do it, attach it to it, put it in that envelope. I can tell you that that's a big thing to do. Myself, I was hemming and hawing about it. I was arguing with myself, and I actually was saying, and I said this to Bean and the guys a million times, I was saying, how can I trust these guys? You know, what would they know? How come they know this? Nobody else seems to know this. These are all the questions people ask.
Well, it does seem incredible, doesn't it?
Yep.
That something like this should be so... When we believe that we're actually being given useful information, when we believe that we're actually being supported by the people who we believe we're being supported by, it really is hard to get to grips with the fact that there's so much of it that could be so useful that is so completely not known.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is, you kind of have to take that jump, you know, and you have to say, well, okay, because... John McCann, Dr. Rock, Vin, or any of the other hosts can't be there to hold your hand all the time, but we are there to guide you and be there for you. But we can't make you, we can eat a horse of water, but we can't make you drink it. But I can tell you what does happen, that you start to lose the fear. The empowerment in doing this is palpable. It's very hard to describe, but all of a sudden you're taking your power back and you're empowering yourself. Yes, you're going into the unknown and you're going down that dark tunnel perhaps because you don't know anything about these things and you have doubts and you have all of these things that they are natural things. And for even if you think about it logically, for people, it doesn't matter what country you're from, what language you speak or anything, for anybody in any part of the world to be put into that position by the very people who are we look up to as the pillars of society, to be actually putting people in that situation is an absolute bloody disgrace.
Yes, yes it is, and to be doing it regularly, day in, day out, month in, month out, and for money.
Yeah.
We've got a question from Ian's just popped up in there. I think we lost one from Neon. He'll perhaps put it in again, but Ian's put in, if you're doing the official offer and paying £50 per month by cheque, would there be any danger in changing the payment method to a standing order?
No. Well, Ian, if you know, you did a job for me and I said I'll pay you by cheque and I said, look, I haven't got a cheque, here's some cash and here's a standing order. Would you refuse it? No. It's still what we class as, what we term as payment, isn't it?
Yes. I think it's important that people understand the difference between a standing order and a direct debit, perhaps, which is that you have the power to stop a standing order and it's for a fixed amount, isn't it? Whereas the bank gets to take what it wants on a direct debit under certain circumstances, and there are new direct debits, aren't there, that the individual can't stop. Standing orders, standing orders are all right, but we wouldn't go for a direct debit because they might just try to take the whole bloody lot.
Yeah, well, you can go in and do it. I do it by postal order, which costs an extra few bob, but, you know, what can you do? And Vin says standing order is a preferred method by everybody, because with a direct debit you're committing to that amount, you know.
Yes.
Let's say 6 months down the road you can't even pay what you promised to pay with the official offer, you know.
Yeah.
So a standing order can be changed, with a postal order it can be changed. Direct debit is a different thing altogether, isn't it?
Yes it is, yeah.
And you don't want to be paying the same bank a different amount by a direct debit from the same bank.
Different.
You have to go to another bank,
yeah,
and open up another account to pay by direct debit to the other bank. And it gets messy in my head, because it's all banking anyway, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I must admit that I'd have to use the standing orders, not the postal order, simply because I gave up the banking sort of 15, 20 years ago.
Ian is saying, sorry to cut across, checks, postal orders can be forgotten. No, postal order, you get a receipt with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You get a receipt, and they always tell you in the post office, don't lose that receipt, keep that receipt. It's verification of payment.
Yeah, and when you post these things, do you have to do them registered, or do you just use the usual first-class stamp?
I would register the initial official offer, you know. Other than that, I just use a stamp.
Okay.
And what I do is I write the, I don't write anything to them, I put the so-called account number, which isn't the original account number. This is funny, but that's another conversation. I write that when you flip open the flap on it. I write it on the envelope there, that when they open it and they look in it, they can see account number, blah blah blah, and the postal order is in it. There's no extra words. There's no writing to them. There's no hi, how you doing, dear sir, blah blah blah, please accept, nothing. The account number is on it, and I can tell you, I can verify this, that by their statements that they've received them. If they haven't received them, it's their problem. I have slips to say that I've done this procedure, so obviously you keep all those receipts for those things. Anytime you're paying anything for these banks, always keep a receipt. Very important.
Yeah.
It's a double thing. That one, you have it there. They might have it on their account. They might say, well, we didn't get it this week. But there's my slip that was paid in there through the postal service, and I paid for that service. So if you didn't get it, you're going to have to sue the post office for that, because that's what they do.
Yeah. Lord knows they're having enough difficulty dealing with their own computer problems.
Yeah.
Vin's clarified in there, he's put direct debit. With a direct debit, the bank can remove any amount they require from your account if the funds become available. Something I've experienced myself. And he's also put, you can call the post office to see if a postal order has been presented. So you might be able to, as well as having your little receipt, you can get a bit of additional information there. And then Ian's clarified, he said, no, John, what I meant is that you can forget to send a check, which is a fair point as well.
You can forget to go down to the post office as well. I have done that, Ian. This month, I forgot all about it. I've got that lax with it, which is stupid. But, with a direct debit, you're saying that has to be paid in a specific date. You know, with the official offer, you don't have to detail that you will pay it in, say, the 1st of every month or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Once it goes in for that month, it goes in for that month. You see?
Yeah. Does it make any difference if you say, if you pay every week instead of, pay smaller amounts every week instead of every month?
Well, that could be better, because you're doing fourfold, aren't you? That means that your intent is not only to pay it once a month, and your intent is to pay it four. You're going in every week, so this is on your mind. This is your intent.
Oh,
it's
so
even
you're
better
you're,
again.
You're,
you know?
You're performing four times better.
Exactly.
Right, okay. That's useful. And Vin's also, this business, you said that it was good to register the official offer itself, but there was no need after that. Vin's put in, if you do not write the official offer in the first place, the bank are entitled to accept any monies you have sent as part payment. Sorry, that's just been obscured by a Skype message. As part payment only, which will offer you no protection. Therefore, you must write out the official offer. So establishing the contract is absolutely crucial. And after that, it's a matter of waiting to see what happens. And
yeah, well, you see, it's a written word. It's an official written document. And you've classed it as an official document, but that's why it's called the official offer.
Okay, so even the word official is really important.
It can be, yep. They will probably laugh at it or say, to make you, but, you know, they say what they like. But that doesn't change the fact that it's written in ink, and you are performing on it, and your intent is to perform and your capacity is at this stage that particular amount. And that is the consideration, you know, and they're accepting it, but they're trying to let on that they don't, but they've already accepted it. So in effect, you have changed the contract. They don't want you to think that you have done that. So when we get to court, they're not going to mention any of these things. They're going to couch it in all sorts of language and trying to make you out to be a snivelling, unreliable person. And how dare you do this to us, etc., etc., etc.
See, that's quite shocking as well, isn't it? I guess perhaps we get a bit complacent about this, but the fact that these people do know one thing and act entirely as if that thing was not true, and they do know, it's not a matter of belief, they do know how this works, but they're behaving as a body, the whole thing is behaving as if what it knows to be true is not true. And makes you wonder how long such a situation can sustain itself once people are aware that that is what the situation is.
Ah, yeah, but to be fair to them, which I'm not really most of the time, but, you know, if a default to them is one missed payment.
Yeah.
You see? So they take it to the letter of the meaning, or the meaning of the word or whatever, the letter of the law, when it suits them. And they also do it the other way when it suits them. And they can play around with these things. And they can turn around and say, well, we let you go for, say, 3 months and we didn't say anything to you, John, because we are so caring, such caring people, you know. In fact, we don't have to even, that MABS thing, we're doing this out of the goodness of our hearts. That we are complying with the wishes of government, even though we're unregulated, and we don't have to actually comply with this. But when people go through the MABS thing, basically what they do is they look at it and say, well, thanks for doing that, but we're not accepting that. But it makes them look like that they're so kind and we want to help our customer.
But we know, don't we, that they're actually in some way obliged to do this.
Well, in fact, they're not. Not if you're a vulture fund coming from another jurisdiction.
Right.
Because of some European regulation that's hidden in the background that the banking system and the shadow banking system all came up with, because they weren't getting enough money out of what they were doing ordinarily. You know, these guys are into making money. That's all they're interested in, is making money. But they want to let you think that they're doing you this big favour by, you're coming into my bank and asking me for money, to lend you money. How dare you? Well, you know.
Customer service, how may we seem to help you? There's a good one for Gary. It's one I've been wondering about, actually, and that which Vin's answered, but it is the official offer just used for mortgages? Or does it have other uses? Because obviously our house is only of limited use to us if people are going to do things like cut the water and the heating off and things like that. So is it more generally usable?
It is. In fact, we in this country, people have been using it for years and years and years without calling it anything. In, let's say, their electricity bill, you could go down to your post office where they take utility bills, you know, and they come along, you go in and say, well, I owed them 200 for the last 2 months, you know, but I haven't got 200 to pay them, but I can give them 50 this week, 50 next week, and 50 the week after. They will accept them.
That's very useful as well. That's very useful. I don't remember hearing that before. I figured it was probably the case, though, because if it's all contract and it applies to one contract, then presumably it can be generalised.
Well, I remember doing that for different periods of time, you know. And you just go in and just say, with your bill, and say, I want to take 20 off that bill, please. They take the account number, they send it through, and they actually staple the payment, the receipt, onto the bill, the utility bill.
Yeah.
That's what they do. Well, that's the official offer in another guise.
Right. Very useful. Neon's put another question in there. This is another one that I wouldn't know where to begin to answer this, especially given what comes after. But Neon's put, is the official offer an ecclesiastical process? They kind of all are, aren't they?
Well, okay, that's a very good question in a sense, because somebody was asking me, was I feeling Christ-like? But if you want to go down that ecclesiastical and biblical thing, it does say, you know, to talk to your lender before he brings you to court, and you might find yourself into prison.
Mm-hmm.
If you have trouble with somebody, meet them and make some arrangement. That clearly says, I don't know what passage it's in, but it does say that, which is basically saying, before you end up in jail and before you end up in court, go and talk to your adversary and try and come to some agreement, you know, to work it out before you go into the court, because the court will put you into prison.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's in Matthew or one of those things. It's very clearly written, that aspect. So that's, in effect, is what you're doing if you want to go down that road of righteousness and ecclesiastical, etc., etc.
I seem to remember Rob F., who's in the chat box with us today. Hi, Rob. Suggesting that by and large it's better to get things engaged in writing before you end up in court, and I've heard other people saying that as well.
Yep.
So we've got Mahatma Coates saying, I think it was bailiffs at the door earlier, we owe them 300 plus gas arrears, don't know how to official offer them, to be honest. Well, that's what we're trying to cover here tonight, Mahat.
Well, I suggest to Mahat, I think it's the same. If you go down to your local post office with your utility bill, I can't see why it can't be done, because most things here are a copy of the UK anyway, because we're still under the crown. So there might be slight variations, but not that. So if I can go down with my electricity bill or gas bill and pay something off it, and they give me a receipt and they actually attach it to it, with that receipt, I'm sure it can be done in the UK as well.
Yep, that sounds good. Well, it sounds like an ideal opportunity, Mahat. I mean, if you've got bailiffs banging on the door and you owe them 300 beer tokens, surely it's a good chance to try it. Have you got anything to lose? I guess that's the question, isn't it?
Well, you see, if they come, if the bailiffs come, if you want to open the door to them, or if they have access to cutting you off outside of their house or apartment or wherever you live, you can say, hold on a minute, lads, I've had this arrangement and here's the receipts I've been paying. Are they going to cut you off then? I doubt it. If they do, you can say, you can probably take them to court.
Yes.
Fairness of everything, you know?
So your receipts are useful not only to prove things to the bank and other interested parties, you can use them just for the blokes who come round to cause you a bit of inconvenience.
Absolutely.
Like you say, if you choose to open the door and talk to them anyway, like you say, if they've actually got the ability to cut your electric or water off from outside, then you might have no choice but to engage.
Yeah.
But
over here, without going into all the utility thing, because we're trying to stay on the official offer, over here, what they've done is they've put in meters. They give you a prepay meter, which effectively is you're cutting yourself off. And it is more expensive because if you go into, that's another subject. But,
yes, we want to try and keep it on the official offer, don't we? The utilities bill thing, it is something I'd like to find somebody to talk to about, because I know that we're making progress there, but we want to stay fairly tightly on topic tonight if we can.
But I think you just go down to your post office and ask them, do they accept payment for your utility bills? And then if they say, yeah, sure, well, I'm sure they advertise these things. Most post offices do that because that's where they get their income from. They get a percentage out of that facility. The utility companies now don't have offices and stuff like that where you go and pay directly to them. So they utilise the post office system for access to people. And the post office use that system and they get paid a certain amount out of something for having that facility, for facilitating these companies. So the person in the post office is not going to say, I can't accept this, because you're offering them money. It's nothing to do with them. It's only one little part of the service, like buying a stamp, etc., etc.
they're acting as an agency, aren't they? They don't actually have any authority at all.
No authority whatsoever. And you're in the driving seat with that because you're paying money. They can't refuse money. They've no authority to refuse money.
Mm-hmm.
And once they give you that receipt and attach it, they staple it to the bill. Just like I say, staple the thing to the official offer. They actually do that. I'm surprised that it's not normal or hasn't been in the UK because it's been in this country for years. And in fact, the utility companies, what they do is they spread over your payments because, let's say, we use more electricity and gas and everything during the winter periods. So what they do is they spread out the payments. Let's say it's costing you $2,000 a year. So if you divide it by 12, instead of paying the 2 months that the big bill's coming in December, January, etc., spread the payments over, and they say, well, if you pay them 30 quid a month or whatever, that covers everything.
Yep. Yep.
Which is like another form of official offer, in a sense. Mm-hmm. It's spreading out the payments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny, the staple thing, because I just remembered that when I first started working in heavy industry, we used to get paid in cash in a little brown envelope with a window on it, which is another subject. And the payslip, the envelope, and the cash were all stapled together. And I used to think they stapled the money into the envelope. I wondered why they stapled the money into the envelope when it was sealed, but I wonder if they were doing the same thing. Yeah. So we've written an exact letter, which it's really important that we write exactly as offered on the official Offer Made Simple site. We've stapled payment to it.
And it's the maximum you can pay.
It's the maximum you can pay. We've sent it under signed for post. And despite the fact that these people know that they cannot refuse, which effectively means they have to accept the offer that we've made, they make all sorts of trouble, which can take a long time. You said in your case you've been stringing this along for 4 years now and haven't been taken into court, but eventually you say many or most people who try this do end up getting dragged into court. So you've sent the offer, you're giving them the payments, anything they've been sending to you, you return to sender. How do you end up under these circumstances in court? What's going to happen?
Well, their thing is that a default has occurred, maybe one payment or two payments or whatever. So that's their whole argument, a default has occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have to argue that you are doing the best of your ability and maintaining your intent, good intent, to maintain that you're not ignoring it, you're doing it. And in fact, if, let's say, you want to pay it every week instead of every month, you're performing four times, which it's all good from your point of view. They're going to argue that it's not enough money. That's all they're arguing. The only can all argue is you're never paying enough. If it's not the actual amount, you're never paying enough in their eyes. So they're trying to get you, make you another offer, except you're in court at this stage. But it's another offer from them. That's why you don't answer the phone calls, because they're trying to contract with you to make you an offer or you to up the payments and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know. So let's say that you're in court and they're just going on the default thing. Well, you can say, well, yes, at that time, I didn't know what to do. So I've made an offer and I'm paying it every month, sticking to this agreement. And when my circumstances change, you can change it. You know.
Yeah.
Whether the judge accepts that, the judge really doesn't have, if you think about it properly, it hasn't happened as yet that he'd come along and say, oh, that's okay, move along, that's fine. Do you have to go through all this rigmarole and these other guys are coming up which are just representatives of another thing? When you go to court, there are certain rules and procedures that they must adhere to just as much as you must adhere to. And one of them is they must have a competent witness. The barrister for the bank or the voucher or whatever they are, is not a competent witness. He only represents their case. If you want to go into all sorts, you can demand that a competent witness is there from the bank, which inevitably they probably refuse because they say, well, that person is not working in this bank at this point in time. There are lots of ways of getting around all that.
What exactly are you asking for when you're asking for a competent witness?
Well, then you can ask them the questions that you need to ask if you want to go down that road. Because they will turn around and say, well, I didn't done this. If you go in and say, I don't have this contract and I want you to document and verify the obligation and all the rest of it, they try and go over that, jump over that and say, did you get the money? They don't want you going into that sphere. So they come up with things like, did you get the money? Now,
could you ask them what money is?
Exactly. Or you could ask the judge, are they saying that I got the money? Then you could go into, perhaps, what is money? Because you actually didn't get money when you got your mortgage. You got a check. Yep. Nobody got money. You got a check. So that's another argument. If you want to go down that road, I don't think it's advisable to do that. I think you just stick with the official offer, your intent, the contract law, the seven elements, those arguments. Because if you go down to try and sting them in any other way, they are well equipped to come up with all sorts of stuff that you've never heard of yet.
So you stick with the fact that you intend to pay and you're demonstrating that you intend to pay by actually paying. And that is your point. That's where you try to stick.
And you could say, if my circumstances change, I can pay more money. They might say, well, they have deemed that it's unsustainable. You could ask them, deemed, have you the authority to deem anything in the future? Can you see into the future? Stuff like that.
Yeah. Deem is an interesting word, isn't it? Because it's
can they see the future? Who gives them the authority to deem it a particular way about someone's life? You know, let's say I write a book today and it's a bestseller tomorrow. Well, then how can they, or something silly, you know, make a record and somebody actually buys it, or you know, write a book of poetry and. Or do a painting, or come up with a new business, or, you know, they're writing your life off. They can't do that. How can they say that? They can't be, say, with any sort of sense of positiveness that they can foretell the future. They can't foretell their own future, never mind yours.
Life is a series of ups and downs. There's paces, times when we can afford things and times when we can't, and nobody can guess where those moments are going to be.
So it is fraught with danger. There's no doubt about it. So then the next thing is, and I haven't learned all the aspects of it yet, but I will be when it comes to time. But yep. There are other lads and lassies in there at the moment, and they're exploring various options as they're doing it. And so far, it's kind of working out very well. It always goes to a point. Yeah, right. You don't want to complicate it, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
It's complicated enough. So you don't want to complicate it. But if you come out there and you're still allowed, or they might say, look, can you pay an extra amount? The judge says, well, you'll probably say, okay, I'll try, because you're willing to do whatever you need to do because your intent is good. So the judge might lend you a hand and say, okay, and if circumstances change, you promise to pay extra money, etc., etc. Or you could go down the route of what the Master of the High Court said, just pay with a promissory note. I'm not sure about that, whether that actually will suffice.
It's, again, a complicated business, the promissory note, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's valid in theory, but some people have difficulty making it stick because it's a complex process.
Well, you see, a government can pay with a promissory note. Whether actually money ever changes hands is another thing. we don't know. We're not privy to all of those things. You know, so mm. they are discussions for different discussions as far as I'm concerned. So let's say we go in and we're not going in there to crash the banking system because they won't allow you.
Well, we've seen what happened. If the banking system was going to crash, it would have crashed.
Yeah, exactly.
For sure.
So, yeah, and they ain't going to let you do it, you know?
No.
They just are not going to let you do it. Whether that's right or wrong, they're not going to let you do it. Because no judge is going to take that responsibility forever, not ever more be known throughout history or centuries as the judge that collapsed the whole world's banking system.
It would be a pretty unfortunate precedent to set, wouldn't it?
Exactly. So what we want to do is we really want to go out there and get them to say, okay, we've come to another arrangement or whatever, and you stay in your dwelling. That's the whole object of the exercise.
Well, speaking as somebody who chose to leave their dwelling about 4 years ago and has since then been investigating other possibilities and potential, you really don't necessarily want to do it, folks. It's a damp and difficult life. It might appear, when you think about these things, that we don't have any security in our own homes because of the kind of processes that we're talking about tonight, i.e. the processes that are being operated upon us. But really, life outside the home is cold and damp and unpredictable, especially damp. Everything gets really, really damp. And yeah. Keeping a roof over your head, keeping a dwelling, a place for you to dwell where you are deemed to have some right to be, if you actually found yourself in that position, it's a really good idea to try and keep hold of it. I'm sure we'll come up with a solution in the long run, but...
Yeah. Well, you see, we have safeguards here in this country through the Constitution.
Yeah.
You know, Article 40.5.
Yes. I hope to finish the show with a little article from The Land called "And a Small Cabin Build There," and it's about a lady in Ireland who did build a cabin, and she did successfully use 40.5 to protect it. As far as I know, she's still there, so we'll finish with a bit of good news before the end of the show.
Excellent. Well, the reason I'm putting that in there now is because the official offer is the first hurdle, you know, really. It's empowering, taking back the power yourself. But then you'd have to do your own due diligence, as it were, find out as much information as you possibly can, because you have that extra time now in your hands to do so. If you don't pay, they will just take your home away from you, and you don't really have much recourse in that circumstance. You could rely on the Constitution, and it has been done, and that's another program which we haven't been speaking about on People's Internet Radio for quite a while, and I think it's probably time to bring that subject back up again, how to deal with the sheriff and what to do in that situation. Mm. So even though this is a remedy that is going to see you through a longer period of time, and probably at the end of it, you will stay in your home, which is the whole object of the exercise, then if circumstances change and you do get a possession order or whatever, because apparently there are no eviction orders ever issued, how to deal with that situation is another day's work, and it's very simple. And even if the bailiffs come, the sheriff, you see, we get mixed up here with, because we hear all the time in the UK, the bailiffs and the sheriff. The bailiffs aren't necessarily the sheriff over there. Bailiffs are just like the vulture phones here. They're a company set up, usually a security company under this, that and the other. The sheriff is a different matter. But the fact remains that, you know, the sheriff would actually have to physically break into your home. If you don't allow him in and you don't answer and you ignore them and all the rest of it, you know, unless a crime has been committed in the home, they have no legal standing in breaking into your home. They know that. They don't want the people to know that, but that is actual fact. And even if they do carry you out of your home and all that sort of thing is, well, that man has performed his duty for that particular day. He only has to do it once. He can't do it twice or three times. It has to go back to the start. So there's nothing preventing a person going back into that dwelling after the sheriff has left.
So long as he's carried you out, so long as you haven't handed him the keys and walked out under your own steam.
Yeah.
Mm.
The likelihood of him, we've proven that he won't carry you out, but if you start speaking to him, you're giving him a different, it's a different world when you start talking to them, etc., etc. However, even if you do make a total hames of it, when they go, he has performed that duty. He can't come back and perform it again unless the whole court system goes back into action.
Okay, so it's been a process, not an event. Effectively, that's the last thing that happens in quite a long process, and all that happens then is it goes right back to the beginning. You've got some more time. Do they? I take it, it's not popular people walking back into their own homes. Does it take a while to get the whole thing running again? Do they even try?
Well, it's up to the individual, but people don't think that they can actually do that.
Mm-hmm.
So it hasn't been tried to any great amount because people don't know that they can do that. Effectively, you know, what are they going to do? Are they going to put a security firm into every house that they repossess?
Mm.
I don't know whether they can afford that. I don't think they want to do it. They rely on people being afraid of somebody in authority coming to their door. And we answer the doors, as we always say, don't open the bloody door.
Mm.
Don't talk to them through a window, through a wall. Don't do any of those things. And then they have to think about how they're going to actually process this so-called order that they have.
And that's one of the things that I mean, I personally haven't found it successful yet because I haven't had a front door for anybody really to come knocking on. But one of the things I've most frequently been talking to people, because it's one of the things that people most frequently seem to encounter, is apparent bailiffs at their door. And all I've been saying is that, well, when I encountered them, I did talk to them, and it was a huge mistake. It really was, even though, you know, my name wasn't on any of the paperwork. They had no idea that I was even there, all that kind of stuff. Well, I changed all of that when I talked to them. So I basically say, I certainly wouldn't talk to them again. I would do my absolute best to absolutely realise that these fictional characters, they can't possibly knock on your door so you can't hear them. And what was the other question? Am I feeling lonely? I've heard on people's internet radio several people saying that this works, but having had this conversation with people, I now know several people who have done just that. And some of them have now been running for 3 or 4 years and no further problem, really. In fact, the bailiffs in several of the cases appear to have given up, at least for the moment. So not talking to them does seem to be, and I presume that's the case, is it, even if they basically break down your door?
Absolutely.
Mm.
Well, they're after breaking into your home, you know, into your dwelling.
Yeah.
Have they got a good reason to do so? Who gave them the authority to do so? Is there any law anywhere or legality to say that you have to actually talk to anybody?
Mm.
You don't even have to talk to a copper, a guard. They actually do tell you, you know, anything you may say will be taken down and used against you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they actually tell you that. They actually tell you to shut the hell up.
Yeah.
But what do? We always talk.
I know, it's
a natural instinct.
It is, well, yeah, it's certainly I don't know whether it's natural or whether it's actually part of the training that gets put into us, but yes, it is extremely difficult to stay quiet. It is.
But there's no law anywhere to say that you have to talk to anybody.
Mm.
You know, it's not written anywhere.
Yeah.
To say it. People might think that you're being rude or something, but in that situation, so what?
Yeah.
Normally, you wouldn't be rude to somebody calling to your door if you knew them. You'd be welcoming and say, hello, how are you? What can I do for you? You know, all that sort of thing. But you don't have to do that if you don't want to. What can happen? Nothing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you do, effectively, I get, just by opening your mouth, you seem to enter, I mean, you're standing quite happily in your inviolable dwelling, and just by opening your mouth, you're effectively rendering it violable.
Exactly.
Mm.
You're, it's like a laser. going through the walls, you know.
Mm.
And you're contracting with them, you know. You're, in the sense that you're recognizing them. And once you recognize them, then they can do all their spiel. And it looks like in the UK particularly, these so-called bailiffs, which I don't think they're necessarily any authority. It looks like that they're even so-called stuff that they're writing in court, and it's not even a court. And all this kind of stuff has been shown to be the case with Guy Taylor and everything, you know, because people actually started looking at the documents, and you'll find that if you do find yourself having to talk to them, when you look for these documents, they don't want to show them to you. Why would he not show them to you? I mean, if you were doing that job or I was doing that job and it was legitimate and you thought you had authority with this piece of paper, it would be the first thing you'd be showing to people.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. They can't document and verify even their most simple activities.
Exactly.
Mm. So what about if... So we've obviously we know of some people who've been taken into court with the official offer. They've made it out again. They're still kind of paying the maximum they can afford. Do they find themselves getting drug into court again? You know, or if you do survive the court experience with, you know, further and research, is that it or?
Yeah, well, you see, well, the way the court system has worked out, that you have different courts. You have the Circuit Court, you know, and then you have the High Court and the Supreme Court, and they're trying to push a lot of stuff through the Circuit Courts, but as far as I know, they are only allowed to deal with civil matters up to a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
So they will say the likes of, well, I'm going to take this to a judge, you know. That's exactly what you want, where you want to go. They use it as a kind of a semi, it's not a threat, but you say, well, this will have to go to a judge. I haven't got the wherewithal. It's not my remit to see this. If, let's say, you bring up the Constitution or you bring up something else, they say, oh, that's not in our remit in the Circuit Court. We'll have to bring it to a judge. And sometimes by saying that, people say, oh, I don't want to go to a judge. But actually, a judge is the one... he was going to determine, there's where you can argue legalities or their legalities or whatever we want to call them, because the others in the Circuit Courts mostly are not judges. What you call these?
So are they magistrates or something?
Magistrates, yeah, right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So they can only deal with stuff up to a certain amount of value and other petty offences, etc. Other than that, if it's a serious offence, a crime of some description, you go to the criminal court, you know. But we're not dealing with criminal courts. We're dealing with civil matters. So they will say, yeah, well, this will have to go to a judge.
Yeah.
Excellent. That's where I want to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
See?
So...
it's another trick that they use.
Yeah. So, so they're drawing... So as well as all of the other stuff, they're dragging you into a court which isn't actually applicable.
Yep.
My God.
Because you have to go through the procedures, a process.
Mm. If they want to get you into the High Court, they've got to get you into the Circuit Court first.
Yep.
Mm.
There's a process that it goes through, and then it goes to them. And even if you're lost in the High Court, you can always go to the Supreme Court.
And has anybody taken it that far yet?
There are people taking things, different things, to Supreme Courts. But then again, when you get up the ladder, as it were, actually there has been a case taken, not for mortgages, but to do with the Lisbon Treaty, because we had to vote twice for it in Ireland, because we said no the first time. So it's something called abridgment rights or something, which they have broken by doing that. So some judge is after saying or that they are going to hear the case properly, and they've ordered the state to come up with the document and verify the obligation for the people to vote a second time. So I'm giving them 3 weeks, apparently, to do so. So that's going to be a big one. But again, other people have gone in and they're trying to talk about various things. If you don't ask the right questions, you ain't going to get the right answers. But that doesn't mean that what you try to do, if this makes sense, isn't there to be done.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be so precise. I think that's the way I'm looking at it now. I could be wrong, but the higher you go up, you have to be really, 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 really precise. As I say, if there's no point in asking about how to grow potatoes and then someone tells you about growing turnips, you know, because there might be some slight difference in all of that. But if you don't ask the direct question and make sure it's into the thing, I think you're in a lot of trouble. And, of course, the other thing that hampers people from doing that, because the cost of these things can be astronomical.
Well, that's another thing I was thinking about, is that all of these, if we're talking about 100,000 people who are in trouble, the actual cost of all of this through the courts appears to be huge. But, of course, one of the oppositions we're facing is that everything that appears to be expensive to the system is, in fact, earning the system money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. So, we shouldn't have a court system that people can't afford to go into it. Now, they got around that by free legal aid, as they call it.
Which is now being pretty much withdrawn, isn't it?
No, it's still there in Ireland, very much used. Yeah. But that's putting the onus back on the state to pay those people for that. And because it'd be a small part of the legal system, yeah, the waiting lists get longer and longer and longer and longer, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You said that there's kind of rules for the court, rules and procedures that they've got to obey and you've got to obey. Are those in the public domain? Can we find out about those before we go in?
Can. It's all there.
And are they easier to understand than legislation?
Well, there are certain procedures that have to go through, you know, like certain things have to be registered before. Affidavits have to be done before this and before that. There's time limits and there's various things, you know. And there's plenty of things there that people are beginning to tease out and find out about.
Yeah. I think it was Neon that asked on the way through there, how important is conduct in court?
Very, very important. Very important.
So they're expecting you to be respectful?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you wouldn't go to a job, you know, dressed in dirty trainers and whatever, you know,
yeah,
for an interview. So if your dwelling is or let's say if it was a criminal thing, you want to look your best, because what you look like, even though you don't want to look like that for that particular time, you don't like wearing suits or you don't like wearing ties or you don't like wearing this or whatever else. All these things tell a tale. It's like if you're going for an interview for a job. As I say, if you come in a suit and look smart and clean and tidy, well, that's first impressions, you know. In law, they shouldn't matter what they do. It's just kind of a respect thing. As I say, you're not up on a criminal charge. It's a civil matter. But if you're going to go into court, you have to sort of show some respect.
Well, I guess if you're going to go on the stage, you need to wear the costume.
Well, there you go. That's it, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's not going to kill you.
Mm. So, you know? What we're saying, which this is one of the things I really like about this, it is a survivable situation, but there are risks attached. And you've got to, if you're going to take responsibility for it, which you're being forced to do, it's up to you to make sure that you're equipped to take that responsibility on.
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Hmm.
And people can only be helped, and there's plenty of people to help as much as they can, within reason, of course. And... you know, we're all learning, and we're learning at a very fast rate. And the people who are in there at the moment, we see them as trailblazers. really, because when you think about it, that's exactly what we are, because the system itself does not allow for what we are doing. If it did, you wouldn't have to come to People's Internet Radio to find out this information. You could just walk into a solicitor and they say, I'll tell you what, John, why don't you do the official offer? Yes. They don't want you to do that, because they want instant money. They don't even look at the long term. If, you know, some people would say, well, look, we're not getting the full amount of money, but if enough people were doing the official offer, if 50,000 people were doing the official offer, do you not think that the banks would have to change their tune?
Yeah, wouldn't that be good to see?
And if you take it to the UK, there was a chap on, and he was talking about 10 million people losing their homes. Now, I don't know where he got that figure. Could be right, mightn't be right. But let's say 1 million people in the UK at this point in time are probably, that's probably a good estimation, wouldn't you say, out of 60 million people?
Yeah.
1 million people, at least, may be in trouble with their mortgages. So if 1 million people were doing the official offer, I think that would make a huge dent in the attitude of the people who are throwing people out of their homes.
Yeah, I agree. And it seems that basically, whatever it is that the guys in the dark T-shirts can do, because they can do it, we can do it too. So we need to be really studying their behaviour, don't we?
Yeah, we don't have to behave like them. However, we have to, as I say, you're not going to go in there all guns blazing, half-cocked. You're going to be eaten, you know. Go in there with good intent, shown to be performing on this particular issue as best you possibly can. There has to be some equity and fairness put to that. If you decide that you're to hell with it, I'm not going to pay anymore, you ain't going to win anything.
Mm.
Well, you'll have a harder battle. You might.
It's easier if we look for a resolution and a peaceful resolution.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And as I say, if enough people are doing it, and you can imagine, we're trying to get this information to as many people as we possibly can, and we have the naysayers, you know. We have the people who want to sort it all out, you know, and if they do that, fair play. But at the same time, there's so many arguments that can be put up about this, I'm not sure whether any of them really make any sense at the end of the day.
No.
Lots
of the other things seem to maybe work once for one person or individual or whatever, but then they don't work again, and that's the, you know, the official offer has been a sustained performer so far, hasn't it?
Exactly. And it makes you stronger, it empowers the people, and they're learning, and somebody else might get involved with the PIR research team and encourage other people to get involved. Because essentially that's what we need, is plenty of people getting involved. The more people that are giving this message to people, whether people take it up or not, that's their choice. But we need soldiers, I suppose you could say, out there giving this information to people, because it's good information, it's true, it's honest information. We don't charge for it. We might ask you to pay a little donation into the site. If it went to the case where people were just abusing it, but then we'd have to change our mind about that. That happens the odd time, you know, people trying to be smart. But we're looking for genuine people, and we're looking for people who want to spread this message and give it to other people. And as I say, if you do the math and do the numbers, the more people that are doing this, it forces the hand of the other people.
Yeah. Well, that's absolutely great, John. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed that conversation, and it's something I'll feel a bit more confident with dealing with. It seems to me that it's all around good news, and 10 out of 10 to you for all of the work you're doing.
I'm doing very little compared to other people.
I think.
Anyway, it's been a pleasure for me to be on the Dr. Rock Show, the inimitable Dr. Rock, folks. absolutely brilliant.
It's great to have you on, mate. You're always welcome on the show. And I'd like to say I found that personally very helpful. Hope people out there found it helpful and people who listen to the podcast. John McCann is, of course, one of PIR's very own, and you can hear him every Saturday evening between 9 p.m. and 11 p.m. on Talk and Tea with John McSee. Great show you did the other day on biodynamic farming.
Oh, I love that. That was great, John.
So you're covering a fair bit of ground, so it's like
well,
you say,
I have two co-hosts now with me, Dale and Sean, and it's just an opportunity that we can go into different spheres. And that's in a developmental stage. Nothing is planned, but maybe this week we might go into wilderness, you know, something like that. I've been trying to push this a little bit. This should be very interesting. Last week, Sean did a great job, and the week before I wasn't here, and Dale did a fantastic job, so it's absolutely brilliant, you know.
It's really great, isn't it? Going from strength to strength.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, thanks very much, John. That's totally awesome, and I'm sure we'll get to talk again.
Hopefully.
And I'll play a couple of tunes, and then before the end of the show, like I say, I'm going to come back with this small item from the Land magazine. We're not going to get touched the rest of the stuff that I thought I might do tonight. I can save it for another show, but I want to talk about this, talk about the Constitution and the fact that somebody did manage to build a shed that they can live in. So I think that'll be a good way of finishing off.
But excellent.
In the meantime, thanks very much for being there, John. It's been great chatting with you, and like I say, you're always welcome, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. It's been my pleasure.
Okay. I'm just going to play a tune. This is for Synchro. As you know, she's sometimes on the show. She's out there with the kitchen posse. They've been very well behaved tonight in the kitchen. They did break out and start rioting in the corridor a couple of weeks ago. But here's Eat Static and Crash and Burn for Synchro, and I'll be back with you in 8 minutes or so.
You're listening to www.peoplesinternetradio.com. Seeking solutions.
There you go. That was Motorhead and Girls' School doing Please Don't Touch. And we've been talking tonight with John McCann about the official offer, which I thought was extremely illuminating. These excellent techniques, they are, in essence, especially when you compare them with many of the techniques that don't work. Now, they're in essence pretty simple, but none of these things are really, really safe. It's important for us to know thoroughly what it is we're doing and thoroughly what is expected of us, and especially it's important to know how to behave. But basically, we're getting there, and I'd really like to thank John McCann. It's always a real privilege and a pleasure talking to him, and that is one of the methods, one of the systems that is definitely making a huge difference to people. As he says, it's keeping people in their homes, it's preventing people from committing suicide, and as I said, the most important thing, guys, take it from me, is that it's keeping you and your tackle dry, because by and large, once you don't have regular access to the kind of things we used to, like central heating and oil and that sort of stuff, and once you're endeavouring to live in, what, I don't know, it doesn't matter what it is, it might be an older caravan, it might be a static caravan, it could be just a shed with a single skin wall, you can end up trying all sorts of things, but the one thing they have in common is that unlike the proper house you've got over your head, the proper dwelling you've got, one way or another, none of them are actually dry, and that you know, actually you get to appreciate that fact once you do find yourself in somewhere that's really pretty warm and dry. We're lucky enough to be doing that at the moment. So yeah, big thanks to John for the work he's doing and for coming on the show, and thanks to all of you as well for the involvement in the chat box. Let's carry that one forward, shall we? We must all know people who the official offer can be useful to, and it's perhaps one of the best things we can be doing. So I was hoping to actually look at this magazine. I've mentioned it before, The Land, which is an occasional magazine about land rights. Almost by definition, it's not a chirpy read a lot of the time, because a lot of the stuff it has to cover is the prohibitions on the kind of rights we've got. I was going to look at a small article called Land, Debt and the Jubilee, and another one called The Myth of Natural Capital, both of which are basically tales, along with The Trouble with Peasants, about how it is that we, as men and women, have been separated from the land from which stems all of our wealth and equity. Everything we have comes from there, separating us from the land, separates us from everything else. But we don't have time to do that now, because we've had such a thorough exposition, so I can save that for a future show. But at the moment, I just want to finish with an item called And a Small Cabin Build There, which is about a recent planning, not that recent, but a recent planning case in the Republic of Ireland, which may open new possibilities for low-impact self-builders. I don't think I'm going to run over, but if Tony's coming on to play tunes after me, I might be a few minutes over the top. You have to find me, hey, but Laurie's gone to bed, she won't notice. Let me just find where. When Katie Fortune moved onto the land owned by her mother in 1999 with her two children, it was in a cramped caravan with no extras, but she said they were in paradise. And with the help of her brothers and a chainsaw, the undergrowth was hacked back bit by bit to make a driveway. Eventually, she added some outbuildings and built a small, timber-framed chalet set back from the road and tucked behind overhanging trees. She called it the Wilderness. And sure enough, in 2009, Wicklow County Council initiated proceedings under the Planning and Development Act 2000, saying that the structure was a development without planning permission. The Circuit Court granted an order requiring the structure to be demolished or removed, which is a favourite manoeuvre. During the ensuing four-year legal battle, Miss Fortune has been frank about her decision to go ahead and build without permission. "I knew I wouldn't have got it," she said, "but my mother kept saying, put your house up, put your house up." Her partner, Philip, who lives elsewhere, commented, "There was a naivety about it, living on her own land. Katie wanted to put up a small, modest house. She didn't think she was doing any harm." He added, "If you own a plot of land in Ireland, it should be your right to build a family home, not a block of flats or a petrol station, a family home." After an appeal to, and this is Irish, I can't probably say this, it looks like it says Unbord Plainala is what it looks like it says. I've no idea what it sounds like. And the circuit court challenge failed. Miss Fortune appealed to the High Court on the novel ground that Article 40.5 of the Irish Constitution states that the dwelling of every citizen is inviolable and shall not be forcibly entered save in accordance with the law. She won. After personally visiting the site, Mr. Justice Gerald Hogan ruled that despite the chalet remaining an unauthorised development, Miss Fortune has a constitutional right to her home under Article 40.5. He overturned the order to have it demolished. He said that the council had failed to produce evidence that the dwelling was completely at odds with public policy objectives. It was hidden from view and did not interfere with the rights of others. An order to demolish it represented a drastic interference with property rights. Miss Fortune had successfully argued that demolition would compromise the guarantee under Article 4.5 of the inviolability of her home, which ensures that a private dwelling is safeguarded in an extensive manner as befits a free and democratic society. The decision has unleashed a furore amongst the planning establishment amid heated claims that the case has massive implications capable of undermining the whole regulatory system. Oh no, not undermining the whole regulatory system. Dan, dan, dan. One anonymous local authority planning source is quoted in the Irish Times. "It means that if you build a house, especially in a forest, and no one sees you, well then it's now your home and it's inviolable. It's a fairly drastic sort of judgment." She or he added that at a recent planners meeting, most people were incredulous. They figure it's open season now. People will feel more confident now, believing that if they do that, they will get away with it. Get away with it. After noting that Article 4.5, if taken literally, would effectively mean that residential planning control would be virtually meaningless, Mr. Justice Hogan's ruling pointed out to those who might take the law into their own hands, quote unquote, that the, quote, structure was unauthorized, unquote. He said that this should act as a deterrent. Fergal McCabe of the Irish Planning Institute demurred, "I would express surprise that the judge would profess to have planning skills superior to those exercised by the Anbord Pleonala," which I couldn't say before, and I still can't say. "Even if he has said he doesn't want to set a precedent, the reality is that it's there. It would be hard to see it. And anybody else wishing to establish an unauthorised family home in similar circumstances could fail." Environment Minister Phil Hogan has now circulated a letter to planners around the country outlining the seriousness of the situation. It then says legislation may have to be reinforced, but for now the circuit courts are obliged to defer to this ruling, which cannot be appealed to the Supreme Court. Ireland is a land of poets, and embedded in the national psyche are those lines of W.B. Yeats: "I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made, and live aloud, live alone in the Be Loud Glade." Lovely. Well, I don't know how well reinforcing legislation is going to work in terms of resisting the Constitution, but there you go. That's the "And a Small Cabin Would Build There," written by a lady called Jill Barron in the Land Winter Edition 2013 to 2014. And there's a little bit at the bottom here which says, "Will fortune's case favour the brave? An inside opinion." And this is just a little bit written by a guy called Davis Muni, who is a planning consultant, and Eileen Flanagan, who is a structural engineer and natural building teacher from naturalbuilding.ie. Katie Fortune's High Court appeal has produced a ruling that some analysts believe questions the legitimacy of the planning system in Ireland, which has been found to contradict the Constitution. The essence of the judgment was that demolition of the property was not a proportional response to the harm that the building caused. It did not impinge on anybody else's rights. This could be seen as a victory for the low-impact building and smallholder movements. Those who are not doing any harm, trying to live more lightly on the earth, finally have a legal precedent to protect them. It could also be seen as a dangerous precedent encouraging more people to rebel against the system and build whatever they like, wherever they like, claiming a breach of their constitutional rights if challenged. For Katie Fortune, the urgency of building a home more durable than a caravan to shelter her family took priority over everything else. This urgent need for shelter is a common theme in the story of guerrilla builders. Why else would people risk building an unauthorized home? There is a high chance of getting caught, and the consequences can be severe. But because the costs of getting planning permission in Ireland are so high, rarely less than €10,000, and the chances of getting it are small anyway, circumstances force them to go guerrilla. Whenever the authorities demolish unauthorised low-impact homes, the builders say the same thing: they just needed somewhere to live. They found the skills and materials to build a shelter. They made their lives better. They got themselves a little bit further out of the poverty trap. Their immediate need for shelter and protection was a much greater motivation than any possible future consequences were a deterrent. So what impact will the Katie Fortune case have on guerrilla builders? Probably very little. There may be some who will use the ruling to justify their actions, but the consequences of these actions will still be onerous. The DOE has instructed planning authorities to continue to apply planning law as before. The minister is considering legislation, but that will ensure that enforcement procedures can still be considered lawful. Then it will be back to business as usual, and people will still be in need of shelter and will still be forced to defy the law to survive, whatever the consequences. So there you go. There's a bit of a good luck, a bit of a hopeful story. This Land magazine, I've looked at magazines in magazine shops, and they've got rakes and rakes of them, shelf upon shelf upon shelf, sometimes two whole lots of shelves, and rarely is there anything in there that I would even want to look at, let alone read from cover to cover. Both Synchro and I have found these. We've got three or four or five copies of the land now, which we've encountered a couple of times in the recent past. And both of us have found that the subject matter covered is interesting. The people who write about it can write, they can spell, they're well informed, they're extremely good at taking on both parts of the debate in a single article and quoting all of the sources. They look into land rights, they look into communities that are surviving, communities that are not surviving. They keep a regular track on people who are actually winning some of these planning battles and people who are losing and why. We shall be looking more into some of the articles, if for no other reason than the fact that it's yielded some things which might prove to be mine and Synchro's next target for somewhere to go and try and find something useful to do. And in 2 or 3 weeks' time, we shall actually be physically going down for a work weekend at an agroecology project, which sounds to me, with 4 years of experience of living in loads of different places, it sounds to me to be a very, very promising project indeed. So there we go, we've made our way to the end of the show again. It's 11:58. I haven't looked at the Skype room to see if Tony's coming on, but I think he's scheduled to. So if it's all right with you, Tony, I'll just put on a couple more tunes whilst I see to myself, catch up with the hosties chat room, find out what's going on. I should hopefully be back with you all next week. I am due to be in Glastonbury on a week's ceremony of one sort or another, so I'm not quite sure where I'll be or what my broadband status will be or even whether I'll have anybody to talk to, but hey, that's nothing new. So thanks to all of you for being there. Thanks, as ever, to PIR for being there and for continuing to host me and let me on here. And I'll see you all very soon. Keep up the excellent work I know you're all doing. I'm going to play out with Song for Shelter, which is really, I always think of it as a bit of an ode to the rabbit hole. I get deeper into this thing, and it's Fatboy Slim remixed by the Chemical Brothers. And then for the last couple of minutes or so, we'll have a bit of the fabulous Woody Guthrie singing Newfound Land, which is, I'm taking to be a bit of a mission statement on my point of view. So here we go. Fatboy Slim. See you next week. Tar for being there, dudes.